This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote. President Joe Biden says he is committed to keeping U.S. troops in Afghanistan until every American is evacuated, even if that means maintaining a military presence there beyond the August 31st deadline for withdrawal. Biden also announced that he's pushing back his criticism that the U.S. should have more to plan for the evacuation and withdrawal, which has been marked by scenes of violence and chaos as thousands attempted to flee while the Taliban advance. He made the comments in an interview with ABC News. Up to 15,000 Americans remain in Afghanistan after the Taliban took full control of the nation last weekend. Deputy Secretary of State Sherman said the U.S. is reaching out to dozens of countries post at-risk Afghans, while accelerating the evacuation of American citizens, diplomats, and Afghans seeking asylum. For more news, please join us at voanews.com by remote. This is VOA News. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is in the United Arab Emirates after fleeing Afghanistan early this week as the Taliban seized control, according to the UAE. The UAE Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation said that the UAE welcomed President Ghani and his family into the country on humanitarian grounds. Ghani fled Afghanistan on Sunday before the Taliban fighters arrived in Kabul without resistance. Ghani posted on Facebook that the Taliban have won and that he left Afghanistan to prevent a flood of bloodshed. Ghani also denied unconfirmed reports that he had a large amount of money when he fled and noted his denial can be verified by customs. The International Monetary Fund said on Wednesday it suspended Afghanistan's access to IMF resources, including around $440 million in new monetary reserves due to a lack of clarity over the country's government after the Taliban seized control of Kabul. An IMF representative said in an email statement that there was a lack of clarity within the international community regarding recognition of a government in Afghanistan, as a consequence of which the country cannot access special drawing rights, reserves, or other IMF resources. President Joe Biden says coronavirus booster shots will be available starting the week of September 20th, pending approval by the Food and Drug Administration. Speaking from the White House Wednesday, Mr. Biden announced the shots will be free and provided to people 8 months after they received their second shot of the vaccine. President Biden downplayed criticism that Americans would be getting additional protection against COVID-19 while much of the world still waits for their first vaccination shots. President said, "We can take care of America and help the world at the same time." The World Health Organization on Wednesday condemning a rush by wealthy countries to provide COVID vaccine booster shots while millions around the world have yet to receive a single dose. Speaking in Geneva, the emergency director, Mike Ryan, told reporters providing boosters while so many were still waiting to be immunized was, in his words, immoral. Earlier this month, the WHO called for a moratorium on COVID vaccine booster shots to help ease the drastic inequity in dose distribution between rich and poor nations. I'm Michael Brown reporting via remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 19, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia's president-elect is urged to pick 50% women in his government.
We have women in Zambia that have the qualifications, that have the capacity, that have all the requirements that a president or the people of Zambia may need to benefit from.
Gambia declares a health emergency as a polio virus is discovered cover. Coronavirus pandemic cripples Somalia's already struggling healthcare system. An expert will explain the connection between conservation and public health. And Mali marks 1 year anniversary of a military coup with little change.
We believe that even a year will not be enough to really sort out the problem of Mali. We are in August. Nothing has been put in place, at least to set up a committee that will draft a new constitution. And a new constitution is desperately needed.
And sex for food aid scandal in Burkina Faso. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Women's organization in Zambia is urging President-elect Hakainde Hichilema to appoint 50% women and 50% men in his cabinet and other decision-making positions. But some Zambians say appointments in government should be based on merit and not gender. Beauty Katebe, chair of the Zambia National Women's Lobby, says President-elect Hichilema should follow Zambia's constitution, which calls for 50-50 appointments. She says Zambia has qualified women that the country can benefit from.
We need to understand the fact that there has been a call for gender parity at all levels of representation in whatever sphere. And for Zambia, I think we've never reached even 30%. For example, if we talk about decision-making in the positions that are of influence in Zambia, even at parliamentary level, we've never reached even 30%. The reason that we have attributed to this is that this election was like a revolution. People just needed change. So what they were looking at was not whether the vulnerable groups are represented or not. They were looking at getting the change done. And after that, we still want or request that it goes again to the Republican Constitution and look at Article 259B, which requests the person with the appointing authority to look at equal numbers of men and women in a position that mandates to appoint.
What do you say to those Zambians who might say that the appointment in government should be based on merit and not on gender?
When we look at the women in Zambia today, the women in Zambia can only be appointed on merit. We have women in Zambia that have the qualifications, that have the capacity, that have all the requirements that a president or the people of Zambia may need to benefit from. I will take you back to the 2016 elections. The 2016 elections, I can assure you, we didn't have enough women that really could maybe warrant certain things that we may need to be given to the women. But imagine that even when the Constitution of Zambia was reviewed within 2016, amended at a clause that required that women should have a qualification of a general certificate of education, women still went back to school. And today, as I speak to you, our women have the qualification that needed to be obtained. So we have women in Zambia that are equal to the task. But then at times they are sidelined because society in Zambia calls for women to go in the kitchen and cook and not at the deciding table where decisions are being made. Otherwise, it is not talking about women that we are going to get from nowhere and put them somewhere. We have women that are already somewhere just waiting to be placed.
What was the level of women participation in the outgoing President Edgar Lungu's government?
I can say he tried to appoint a few women, but then, like I said in my preamble, I said in Zambia, at all levels of decision-making, we've never reached even 30%. The only position that we are saying now we have maintained and we have retained even in this government that has come is the position of the vice president. the vice president, even if it was TF that was going to go through, we were still assured that we were going to have a female vice president.
Beauty, it's so nice to talk with you, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
That was Beauty Katebe, chair of the Zambia National Women's Lobby. She was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. A political analyst says he does not believe the civilian-military transitional government in Mali will be able to fulfill the February 27, 2022 timetable to return the country to democracy. Ibrahima Kar of Senegal says very little has changed in Mali since the military overthrew President Boubacar Keita in August 2020, followed by a second coup d'etat that brought current leader Colonel Assimi Goïta to power.
The country is still in a very volatile situation. On the military side, there is the rebels, or if I say the insurgencies, are still continuing attacks, killing people, putting the central region in a very, very big insecurity. Two, the political situation has not been stabilized. As you know, there was a coup in the coup, and now the military have taken power. The opposition to the military coup is now really very weak. The new prime minister is struggling to really put in place a strategy aiming at really making the transition a reality. And lastly, the economic situation is going from bad to worse. Trade unions even trying now to organize strikes and other things.
ECOWAS has given the interim government until February 27, 2022 to hold elections. Do you think the government in Bamako will meet this deadline?
As I said earlier, nobody in Mali within the political class, even within the army and within the government, believe that in 2022 the military will hand over the power to a civilian government. The first 6 months of the transition was a loss of time because the then prime minister and then president didn't do much to really start implementing a number of programs that was supposed to really help to make a transition a reality. And as you know, in the security side, the French has decided to pull out from Mali around February next year. And this put a lot of pressure on the army, but also on the interim government. So we don't think that something will happen. And ECOWAS is planning to come, I think, next week to see how the interim government is performing. We will wait until the end of that visit to see if ECOWAS itself also believe that the handover of power will be organized next February. The situation is still tense on that side.
There are some Malians who think that the interim government should be given some time to implement the transitional timetable.
Well, I believe that this government will not be able to implement its strategy in the next 12 months because, as I said earlier, they lost a lot of time in trying to at least to fix a number of problems in the country. Now, the experience of the past also told us that in Mali, you always end up adding more months to the time of the transition. Now, the situation is so bad at the moment on the security side, on the economic side, that we believe that even a year will not be enough to really sort out the problem of Mali. You know, we are in August. Nothing has been put in place, at least to set up a committee that will draft a new constitution. And a new constitution is desperately needed.
Ibrahima Khan is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. Gambia's government on Wednesday declared a national health public emergency amid the discovery of the polio virus in the country. The government says two cases of the type 2 polio virus have been discovered in the country. Health Minister Dr. Amadou Lamin Samaté says efforts are underway to combat the deadly virus. Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Gambia's health ministry says an estimated 380,000 Gambian children between the age of 0 to 59 months would be immunized from the polio virus. This followed the discovery of the type 2 polio virus in the West African country. Dr. Amadou Lamy Samatte is Gambia's health minister.
Actually, it is the poliovirus type 2 that has been discovered in the environmental surveillance. So it is not cases from individuals per se directly, but we've introduced what we call environmental sampling now. So these sewage samples were taken from Banjul and Kotu, and they were sent to the reference laboratory in Senegal. We detected this strain of poliovirus, which has been linked during the sequencing to the strain that was identified in Senegal and Guinea.
The Gambia was certified polio-free in 2004, according to Samatte. He says the last detected polio case was recorded in 1986. Now that polio has been discovered in the Gambia, the health ministry says it is investigating the source of the recent polio transmission.
The assumption is, of course, it was detected here in sewage, but whether the people were on transit from any of these countries to the other, or whether the individuals are resident in the Gambia, that we've not been able to determine yet.
Health Minister Samatte tells VOA that efforts are underway to intensify the health ministry surveillance system to help detect polio cases across health facilities in the country. He says the government is not working alone in its efforts to fight the polio virus.
We're working very hard in collaboration with the World Health Organization and UNICEF and all other partners, and other countries are also engaged. So we're going to do a massive immunization campaign that is going to cover up to 380,000 children aged between 0 to 59 months in this country to give them the novel oral polio vaccine.
The WHO says the newly found virus mainly affects children under the age of 5 years, and it is transmitted by person to person.
We want the public to know that there is no cause for alarm, but the basic protective mechanisms are very important. Good personal hygiene, because we know the route of transmission is fecal oral, especially when people's hands are contaminated with feces, and then when kids play on the ground and they pick items and put in their mouth. So personal hygiene is very, very important, and the proper management of waste, especially liquid waste that come from homes, is also very important.
The health minister has called on parents to get their children to the vaccination sites when the polio vaccination campaign starts. He knows that immunization will help save the lives of children. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butler in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 19. Amnesty International says Somalia's struggling healthcare system has been crippled by the coronavirus pandemic. The group released a report yesterday, Wednesday, titled, "We Just Watched COVID-19 Patients Died." It calls for urgent investment in Somalia's healthcare sector after years of neglect. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Amnesty International's 27-page report on Somalia's healthcare says the global pandemic has hit the struggling sector hard. The Amnesty report quoted a senior Somali doctor saying in one ward on the same day, four elderly men died within 10 minutes because of lack of oxygen. The Rice Group Somali researcher Abdullahi Hassan says health resources are so poor that medical workers too often could only stand by and watch their patients die.
When COVID-19 pandemic came, it laid bare how bad the situation was in Somalia. For example, the response by the government was wholly inadequate. There was only one hospital in Mogadishu that managed COVID-related cases, and that one hospital lacked essential equipment. Health workers who worked in that hospital, they really struggled with patients. They did not have enough equipment. They did not have oxygen supply.
Amnesty says the Somali government allocates only 2% of its budget to healthcare, while security services got the largest share, 31%. Officially, Somalia has had more than 16,000 infections and almost 900 deaths from COVID. But the country's chief medical officer, Dr. Mohamed Mahmoud Ali, told Amnesty the death toll was certainly far higher. Dr. Ali said only those who managed to get to the health facilities and get tested were included official data. The figure is just the tip of the iceberg, Amnesty quoted him saying. Many more were infected and died at home. Amnesty notes that only 15% of Somalia's rural population have access to medical care, and the country has only one surgeon for every 1 million people. Abdikadir Abdirahman Aden is the founder of the Amin Ambulance Service, the only such service for Mogadishu residents. Aden says they have two ambulances to serve people. The ambulance workers get exhausted and it's challenging to get oxygen. Since they provide a free service to people and the companies producing oxygen want money, he says they have problems with oxygen supply. Aden says their ambulance workers are also not very well trained to handle some health issues. The Amnesty report, based on interviews with 33 medical and aid workers, as well as officials and experts, calls on Somalia to use debt relief to invest more in healthcare. In March 2020, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank reduced Somalia's debt from $5.2 billion to $557 million over 3 years. The debt relief aims to bring the Horn of African nation back into the global economy after 30 years of conflict and unstable governments. Amnesty's Hassan says the debt relief also offers an opportunity to improve Somali hospitals.
All this money that is going to be received through debt relief should be managed in a manner that is transparent, that's accountable, and it should be used to improve the health sector in the country.
Ambulance service operator Aden says the health sector desperately needs more medical experts to revive it. He said this sector requires knowledge. The people leading the health sector and working on policies, says Aden, must be people who have a background in health and medicine. If you are going to have people in the health sector who are not familiar with the health system, he says, then it is difficult to improve the health system. Amnesty notes only 0.6% of Somalis have been fully vaccinated against the coronavirus. While a shortage of vaccine is partly to blame, Amnesty says that 19 of the 33 healthcare workers it interviewed in the report refused to take the vaccine despite having it offered. It blamed widespread vaccine hesitancy in part on lack of public information. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A new report by a Harvard University-led global task force details how conservation and public health are intimately connected and should therefore be addressed jointly. Dr. Deborah Kucheva, a member of the task force, as well as a professor of veterinary medicine at Tufts University, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the connection and the efforts to address spillover events, which is when diseases and viruses jump from animals to humans.
So if you start there and then you say, now we need to design interventions and assess how those are working to prevent spillover, then I think one of the important things that's already happening in Africa is to adopt a One Health mindset or a planetary health mindset. And that leads you very quickly to coordinating your efforts to prevent spillover. And when I say One Health, I mean the idea that there's no dividing line between animal health, human health, and environmental health. And so one practical extent of that for Africa, and I'll give a specific example in Uganda, is the establishment of One Health platforms. And so in 2016, the government of Uganda launched a national One Health platform, and it is intended to sort of spearhead collaborative efforts across key government sectors to prevent, detect, and respond to these zoonotic diseases that are emerging and causing pandemics. The individuals or the entities involved are the Ministry of Health, Ministry of Agriculture, Animal Industry and Fisheries, Ministry of Water and Environment, and the Uganda Wildlife Authority. So those four groups form the platform along with some institutional structures, and it's a really important important coordinating piece from which you then can take specific actions, community level actions, to really decrease spillover.
Agriculture has been associated with more than 50% of zoonotic infectious diseases since 1940. But how can we address this issue then while also making sure that the world's growing population is food secure, especially in places like West Africa and the Sahel, where food security is a big issue?
It is a big issue, and I think a focus of agricultural efficiency is going to have to be important going forward. So quality, not just quantity of foods produced and the way they're produced. So that's one. And then two is the idea that we are going to have to shift our mindset to also taking into account safety factors. So not just food security, but also the safety of the food. So shifting practices and behaviors, I think, will be part of the solution.
This paper talks about jointly addressing health and conservation. What would a program that jointly addresses health and conservation at the same time possibly look like in West Africa?
So, you know, it's a good question, and there's a timely example. There's a group called the Society for the Conservation of Nature of Liberia, SCNL, and they've been around since 1986. And really, their approach, it's a non-governmental, non-political, not-for-profit agency, but they lead nature conservation. And as part of that, they have sort of a mandate to educate and encourage and assist understanding the needs not only of preserving nature, but also of preserving biodiversity and sustainable livelihoods. Groups like SCNL have really become dual purpose in many ways. You know, they establish networks of protected areas, and so that decreases the interface between humans and wildlife that could where a spillover event could occur. They also encourage databases, establishment of databases related to species, habitats, threats, and those in turn really inform strategies for, again, limiting risk. I think a key feature is implementing creative programs around alternative livelihoods.
That was Dr. Deborah Kochever, a member of the task force and also professor of veterinary medicine at Tufts University. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Boston. A recent report found that community leaders in Burkina Faso are exploiting internally displaced women, demanding sex or money in return for food aid. One local official said these reported incidents could be the tip of the iceberg in a displacement crisis of 1.3 million people. Reporter Henry Wilkins spoke to a victim in this report from the town of Kaya.
In Burkina Faso's humanitarian crisis, food is in scarce supply. Internally displaced people, or IDPs, at this unofficial camp in the centre-north region, so they do not receive food aid from the state or non-profits. This woman, whose identity we have protected, resides in a host community for IDPs. She says she has been forced to take desperate measures in order to eat. She says she stayed in the shelters for 6 months without having enough to eat, unless she had sex with people distributing food. She was forced into prostitution or forced to beg. Many women in the area, she says, were contracting sexual diseases as a result. She survived in these conditions until her husband came back and they were able to rent a small house. A report last month by the New Humanitarian, a media outlet focusing on humanitarian issues, found that 8 IDPs had been forced into sex in exchange for food aid in the centre-north region. Sam Mednick is a reporter with the New Humanitarian.
Reporting I did with the women that I spoke to and aid officials and government officials, it seemed like everyone knew that this was happening. Few people were really willing to talk about it. The women that I spoke to said that they knew other women who had also registered for food, were having a hard time finding food assistance, and thought that they were being propositioned in the same way that they had been, either for sex or for money in order to add their names to the registration list.
He estimates between 20 to 30 displaced women have reached out so far. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, which provides much of the aid, refused to give an on-camera interview. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kaya, Burkina Faso.
And that's it for this Thursday, August 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Button, Washington, saying have a lovely day.